Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, joins us for the weekly update. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Thank you. It's always good to be with you.
I appreciate that. A year later after Superstorm Sandy, I heard this week about all this flooding going on in England. Have you heard anything specific about Jewish communities and neighborhoods there, or was this simply a one- or two-day affair that's now long over?
Yeah, this doesn't rise to... Even Europe can't even get a good flood.
So it was overstated, no matter what I read about it.
No, it was quite a storm, and I think it's one of the worst that they've had in decades or longer. But I think I have not heard of any reports of the specific problem.
I don't even know if we were on the Friday after Sandy. I should have looked that up this morning. I don't remember a year ago what was going on. If we were already back on the air or not. Maybe we were doing it on the web. Who knows at this point? Seems like so long ago. One thing that's not long ago, it's in the immediate future, in fact, is Election Day. Malcolm, how about a word reminding everybody that even if the races seem to be, seem to have large margins in the poll, it's still so important for our community to get out and vote on Tuesday.
I think that if, people can be skeptical about government, and there's good reason. And they may not think politicians can do a lot, but they can all count. And they know who votes and who doesn't vote. And when you want to make demands later on, when you have interests, communal interests, not just personal interests, but communal interests that you want to see met and you want to be heard, you got to be in it. And it's the one thing American democracy demands of us, and that's to be involved. And this is a fundamental commitment. And take your children to the polls with you so that they see you exercise your responsibility so that they will do it. And we can guarantee you that no one will be drafted, called to jury duty, or IRS come after you because you go and vote. You're on in a pool anyway. It's not like the old days, decades ago, when that was a basis for being called to jury duty.
Even though we keep emphasizing how a lot of these races have been decided already, so to speak, based on the polling, obviously it's never true, but. Never true in its entirety. And there are some close races, local ones here in New Jersey, which we're going to be talking about on Monday. But we should point out that, ironically enough, in New York City, if you look throughout the entire city for a close race, one of them is in the Brooklyn neighborhood. One of them is a quote-unquote very much Jewish-influenced seat. So for our community, an additional reason to get out there and vote.
Absolutely. And you have people who have sacrificed for the community, who have spoken up for the community, deserve to get the support of the community.
And lastly, which I think I point out every year, what would our parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, those who would have given anything to have the right to vote, to participate in a democratic process like this, what would they be saying to us on the eve of an election?
Get off your duff and get out there.
Exactly, and I hope everybody does. Everybody keep that in mind, that Tuesday's Election Day, and obviously we'll remind everybody here. We lost Paul Reichman this past week. How about a word, Malcolm, on his influence in terms of Jewish philanthropy and in Jewish leadership in general?
I knew him and some of his children, and he both his style and his content, I think, are role models. And even though he went through very difficult financial times, as you know, he lost Olympia York, the Empire, look at the articles written about him. And what do they focus on? His integrity, his... the humble way he went about things, his humility, his personal humility, and in business, and the legendary stories of breaking in the middle of critical negotiations to go and daven, but most of all, how he treated people that Jews, non-Jews, people of every stripe, all only said complimentary things about him. Nobody accused him of wrongdoing, and Canary Wharf was a huge financial thing and the collapse of the Olympia York, but he came back, thank God, not to where they were, but he rebuilt it. These are people who did it through hard work, and his tzedakah was even more legendary, how people would line up and how he would not even go to work sometimes because he wouldn't until he finished anybody who was waiting for a check. And we also, today is the funeral for Mr. Halpern, and
right.
I think we all should remember this was another one of the great leaders, and we will miss him greatly, and he has an amazing family, his children who have continue to be involved in every stuck on every cause. And he was really a unique individual.
No question about that. And while we're on the subject of people we're lost, I was rightfully criticized last week for not mentioning Rabbi Avraham Zuckerman, the eldest of Israel's religious Zionist rabbis and the venerable dean of the Mei Akiva Yeshiva Network, who passed away 2 weeks ago at the age of 98. And that whole group of people, Rav Neria, Rav Zuckerman, and others, Rav Druckmann, they have been just an incredible beacon of light and have and formed over the decades a network of schools and a movement in Israel that was completely unprecedented. Obviously, one of the reasons is because there was a State of Israel, which made it more accessible to go ahead and build a network like that. But I wanted to make sure to mention him at this time as well.
But there also is a State of Israel,
right?
Because of
right, 100%. Very good point, and I thank you for mentioning that. The leadership, sometimes we talk about philanthropy, it's so important. We talk about political leadership, it's so important. Sometimes we forget that spiritual and religious leadership also can have a major effect on Jewish history, even when it comes to things that are not necessarily looked at as spiritual or as religious. And I think that that's a very important thing to keep in mind. All right, we'll get to the news of the day, and we'll start, Malcolm, with what happened in Gaza. 5 Israeli soldiers hurt, 4 Palestinian gunmen killed. The IDF and Hamas are clashing on the Gaza border. Terrorists, I'm reading from the Jerusalem Post, terrorists detonate an explosive device targeting IDF soldiers during an operation to destroy a tunnel previously uncovered leading from Gaza to Israel. Give us the details on what happened.
Well, this is, as you remember, this is really the result of a buildup of activity that has taken place. There was a rocket fired against Israel. It was intercepted by Iron Dome. But we've seen more brazen actions by Hamas over recent times. Hamas has been in rapid decline. It had lost, reportedly, its funding from Iran. We know that the Egyptians have clamped down, destroyed many of the tunnels, hundreds of the tunnels from Egypt to Gaza. We know that their financial problems were severe, with Qatar and others removing the funding, and mostly because of Egypt. SEC and Iran may have cut back on some of the funding because of the sanctions impact, although they still had a relationship, but it was much diminished because Hamas did not back Assad in Syria. Second, they were having internal problems. You have this Tamaran group, which is named after the group in Egypt, and that also moved against the government. So you have a Tamarad Gaza movement, and they've been putting up posters and billboards all over calling for the government to be brought down. And I understand that graffiti all over can be seen calling for an end to Hamas rule. And there was a meeting between the security officials in Gaza with Hamas political figures about how to counter this, and they were calling for the assassination of the leaders. So they feel the internal and external pressures. Also, they may want to be proving their bona fides by heating up the situation. They may have miscalculated. It may have gotten out of control. The immediate cause was the tunnel that we've discussed in the past, so I won't go through it. 1.8 kilometers, huge infrastructure. Israel went in to get to the other end of it, brought in tanks to seal it off and to detonate, I guess, the entrances. They were met with resistance then, and the fact that you had rockets fired at it, at the tanks. 5 soldiers were injured in the conflict. We don't know yet how seriously. And this is a brazen move on the part of Hezbollah, whether they were baiting them to come in, whether it was entrapment, whatever. The fact is that Hamas for the first time really engaged Israeli troops. Obviously, they're no match for it. Israel will do what has to be done. They do it with, I'm sure, in coordination with Egypt. The military security cooperation is very good. And you have to look at Hamas's activities. We've talked about it before. You know, they have tens of thousands of missiles. They are looking at the situation in other parts of the Middle East. And we have more and more of a situation of a free-for-all. You know, it's estimated there are 30,000 global jihadists. These are not all of the Islamists, I'm talking about global jihadists, in the countries around Israel, from Lebanon to the Sinai. You have thousands in Hamas and in Syria. This is a changing Middle East. And, of course, developments in Syria exacerbate it.
But I'm trying to understand the tunnel protocol, if you will. I mean, when Israel discovers a tunnel, or anybody discovers a tunnel, wouldn't Israel immediately go and seal it off and take some type of action to just take that tunnel out of commission, so to speak?
They did it immediately, of course, but they did it from the Israeli end.
Right, understood. But
now they went in to deal with it from the Gaza end. This is 1.8 kilometers is long.
Right, it's a long. I know it
took a year and a half of infrastructure.
But meaning, they had never. But they've gone to the Gaza side of tunnels before. No, they've gone.
They've tried to build tunnels all the time. They discovered one in November. They just discovered a new branch.
No, but I'm saying the Israelis end up securing the front end of the tunnel in every one of these situations. Correct. Like they could be met with rockets and gunfire in any of these scenarios.
Well, they're met. They did. They fired rockets against without the tunnel related to the tunnel. They fired at Israeli soldiers periodically on patrol along the border or at the border crossing. So it's not that unusual for them to fire. The escalation here is that they would fire at troops in operation, knowing that their drones are coming in overhead, that they're looking at the sites. And Israel took out two launchers earlier in the week. These are underground launchers. And I think the time will come where Israel will no longer just look for these pinpoint strikes, but hit the places that need to be hit and deal with the threat of a terrorist entity like that.
All right, understood. So now back to the protocol. So now what happens? Israel has troops on both sides of the tunnel forever. How do they keep it out of commission? Like, what do they do to make sure?
You implode it. You blow it up. I'm sure Israel, again, people have to understand it's 800 tons of concrete went into this.
Right.
You have 25,000 concrete slabs. Just everything was covered and the infrastructure in there of electricity stuff, and they wanted to go through it first and also to show the world. And the American ambassador went and issued a very strong statement. Some Europeans went and saw it and were overwhelmed by what they saw. The sophistication of this terrorist operation. And remember, we have the same thing in Hezbollah, but you have it throughout southern Lebanon, where you have an infrastructure where people estimated can live 3 weeks. They have hospitals, everything underground for the Hezbollah when they're ready to use it. It's estimated that 1 in 10 houses in Lebanon has a rocket room, a launcher in the house. The roofs open up, sort of like a sukkah or so.
we could relate.
House, right? So the roof opens up, they can launch and close it, or they store Hezbollah weapons.
But how many of them are connected to other houses and structures?
Many. I'm telling you that in southern Lebanon, it's a huge underground structure. In Gaza, it is not the same, but they have been copying this model, and they've been trying to build tunnels, and they declare their intent. And the Israelis believe that there are other tunnels that they have yet to uncover, and many of them go down deep, so the surface detection equipment often doesn't note these.
Could there be tunnels from Lebanon to its neighbors?
Oh, absolutely.
No question.
But it's, well, much harder to do because you have to dig it a longer distance because the border there is open and it's under constant surveillance. It's not as long, but could they do it? Absolutely.
America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning Radio program. Heard and listened to sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, Rockland County at 91.9 on the FM dial and around the world on the web, jmnam.org.
I don't know if you heard what I said, but they're doing it from Mexico to the United States. And this is Hezbollah, too.
Hezbollah is building tunnels from Mexico to the United States?
Absolutely.
To what end? For what reason?
Smuggling, people, cigarettes, contraband, narco-terrorism.
That was part of your effort to alert the tobacco companies as to what was going on with
Now they're working on it, but that's only one small aspect when you of the tunnel operation, which is also, to bypass border controls.
So with all the sophisticated smuggling operations, this is still number one? You'd think in 2013 they'd have much better ways to get stuff into the United States. This is still the number one way to get stuff in?
It's one of the ways. They do it through multiple ways.
Apparently, the meeting that happened this week between the White House officials and the Jewish groups who met went well. At least that's what the reports were about. But again, the White House emphasized how, when it comes to Iran, obviously one of the greatest concerns of any Jewish group, they would prefer, again, diplomacy. Now, can a meeting go well when the conclusion is that we have to continue diplomatic efforts with Iran?
Well, the meeting only dealt with Iran, and it went more than 90 minutes with four of the top officials of the administration, the four who really do deal with Iran. And it was, I can tell you, very intense. It was a very small meeting, but very intense, where the differences in our positions were clear. The issue that their argument is, we need some time right now, a short, limited period of time, in which to try and test and see whether the Iranians, or expose them, and that the international coalition would not sustain additional sanctions at this time because they feel we've got to give them a chance, and that there are countries who, certainly India, China, but they're not part of this, Russia, that is, and some Europeans who are chomping at the bit to be able to get back into business with Iran. And Iran was talking about already signing contracts with European countries for oil exploration, et cetera. So that is their argument. Our argument is that this strengthens you to have additional sanctions, mm-hmm. because it's what brought Iran to the table in the first place. And the threat of additional doesn't even have to be implemented, because the congressional process will anyway take this time. We have a meeting. There is going to be a meeting of the experts committee between the P5 plus one and Iran. Then there's going to be a meeting of the P5 plus one. Then there's another experts committee and another meeting. The question is this just, as it appears, a stalling tactic where they continue to do exactly what they did? You know, the debate in Iran is not about the negotiations process. The debate in Iran is whether it's mandated at every rally, which is what came out yesterday, that they have to say death to America.
Right.
And we see that Khamenei has been missing for the last 3 weeks. Some people think he has a chronic illness that has been activated. He's 74, and that he is supposedly not well. We saw billboards that went up against the United States. They did take him down. The announcement of the dioxide uranium plant, the advances in the centrifuges, all of this is going on, so that there's every reason to believe that this is simply a delaying tactic.
So you were happy with the meeting because of the increase in interest to ramp up the sanctions?
Well, we didn't say we were happy, and I didn't say I was happy with
it. Well, did you walk out of the meeting happy? Were you glad that the meeting went the way it did?
I would say that I think that the Jewish leaders acquitted themselves extremely well, that the case that was made to the administration was clear, that the effort to try and find a way that we can not have a split, that we have to be on the same page enforcing this issue. We got reassurances that they will not remove any sanctions in the term, but you saw all the reports saying that they're going to remove them, that they would relax them. They assured us that that is not going to be the case, and that the all options on the table, all of the standard arguments, but that we're going in with open eyes, realizing who he was, what he is, and you know, I said, look at the vice president. This is a guy who was head of the Iran Revolutionary Guard in Lebanon when our Marines got killed.
Right.
This 241. He was in charge. I mean, there's no sign that there is anything. And they're saying, look, we got to show the Europeans and others that we went, did everything we could. If they're open, if Rouhani, has opened the door and we slam it, then they'll say, well, there's no legitimacy to the position. And Iran continues to move weapons into Syria. I mean, there's no sign that they are actually looking for a different position.
Right.
And ultimately, if we don't make clear that we're prepared to take whatever steps are necessary, especially after what happened in Syria, where in the region they have no confidence that the United States, the West, will actually act, and we see the deterioration of their position.
And to an extent, Egypt as well.
Egypt even more. I mean, we'll get to it, I hope, because there you have a major shift, and the latest reports are that the Egyptians are negotiating for a Russian missile system,
right.
SA-8.
Right. They can't rely on America anymore.
What Israel took out in Syria.
Right. All right, we should talk about that. Israeli warplanes attacked a shipment of Russian missiles inside a Syrian government stronghold. An Obama administration official confirmed the Israeli airstrike overnight, but provided no details. Another security official said the attack occurred late Wednesday in the Syrian port city of Latakia and that the target was Russian-made SA-125 missiles. All right, so why did Israel have to, in fact, take this action, and does it really escalate matters because these were Russian weapons?
Well, they've been taking most of the weapons they're taking out are Russian weapons. It's not the first time. It's probably the fifth time that Israel's had to act. And when they have information that indicates stuff is being transferred, especially such lethal military equipment, to Hezbollah, is that they are required to act. And here they acted early. They hit in Latakia, which is the naval base we've often discussed, which where a Russian naval where the Russian Navy operates out of in the Mediterranean. It's the only forward base that Russia has since the fall of the former Soviet Union. And they also hit near Damascus, a base near Damascus. This, again, it's not the first time. And the importance is that Israel is saying, we can't worry about where it comes from. It is a message to Russia as well that you continue to supply. We're not going to feel bound by the fact that it comes from you or from anyone else to act against it. And Russia, you know, just will sell them more stuff.
When, I hate to ignore my ignorance, but when they strike a Russian weapons shipment, they are striking it at what point? During delivery, once it's arrived?
No, this is post-delivery.
It's sitting there in the warehouse, and they go ahead and take it out.
Right, and much of it being prepared to be transferred. I mean, that is what Israel is not striking it because Syria has it. Israel hits it because it's going to be transferred. And the you know, Israel cannot allow. We see the aggressiveness of al-Qaeda in Syria, even reports that they're moving closer towards in the direction of the Golan. The inspectors have destroyed, claim to have destroyed all the known chemical weapons sites. Those are the ones that Syria admitted to. We don't know about the stuff they didn't admit to or what they have stockpiled and what's in the area where the Alawites are or anything else. But they have cooperated, and they're claiming that they met the deadline for that the UN called for in the destruction of these weapons. But remember, it's the conventional weapons that are doing the chemical weapons were used in a limited fashion.
Right.
It's not what Assad is counting on. He's counting on his planes, which give them cover and give them a greater firepower than the rebels. The rebels are very divided. 19 of the groups signed a thing that they won't a statement that won't go to Geneva, so they're rejecting the peace talks. And Assad wants to put it off because he thinks he's winning.
What type of weapons is Egypt buying from Russia?
Egypt hasn't bought, but they're talking about buying the same thing that Israel knocked out, these S-8 Gecko mobile missile air defense systems.
There was a prisoner release this week, 26 terrorists from Israeli prisons to facilitate the peace talks continuing. The list of terrorists that were released confirmed that all the prisoners were either convicted of murder or attempted murder of Israeli citizens. Now, this is attached to the prisoner release of a few weeks ago, or this was a new deal? Where did this fall in the in Israel's gestures?
No, this is all part of the deal to free 104 long-held prisoners. These are pre-Oslo prisoners.
Is this the last step now?
This is only the second of four.
So they're going to continue to be protests in Israel, continue to be a big hit to Israeli morale as they continue to see these prisoner releases take place.
Well, when they announce the names and you look at what these guys carried out, the horrific crimes, and you know many of the families of those who were killed, some in mostly in the 80s, I guess, and even in the 70s and early 90s, before Oslo, you understand. I mean, some of them carried out really horrific crimes, abducting and murdering an Israeli soldier. And
you know Bibi pretty well. How does he? He must have a lot of trouble sleeping at night after these decisions.
He says it's the most difficult decision of his prime ministership. He does it, he said, because sometimes you have to make sacrifices. It was voted by the cabinet, even though there was strong opposition and there were demonstrations.
Yeah, but without his enthusiasm for the idea, it would never have gone.
I wouldn't say it's enthusiasm. I would say it's acquiescence to it. He clearly, nobody can be enthusiastic, and when you have to make this choice, when the Mossad, Shin Bet have to clear the lists and everything, everybody gets involved in this, and it is a terrible decision to have to make. but it's a promise they made, and he said you have to show that you're credible.
This announcement that Israel is planning to build 1,500 new homes in East Jerusalem after the prisoner release took place, this was a direct message to the Israeli people that Israel will continue to build even as this peace process continues?
I wish they were building and not talking and making pronouncements, because this is not building. This is, you know, the initiation of the process where they give out tenders and till the tenders go and then get zoned, and it'd be years before there's real construction.
He actually used the word compensation for the prisoner release, Netanyahu.
I know.
That's an unusual step for him to take, no?
It is an unusual step to take, and I think tying construction, if you think it's legitimate and legal, to as compensation for release of terrorists is a mistake. The right to construct and people to have houses, and if Israel postulates that it is a legitimate and legal thing for them to do, why make it appear to be a concession for in return for a major concession to the other side?
I ask you this every couple of weeks. Who's leading Egypt now? Because I read this week of some of their old leadership that's now back in power.
Al-Sisi is leading it, absolutely. He is in control. The army is still operating against, inside Egypt. They have demonstrations. They still have rebels. You have Islamic Brotherhood, Muslim Brotherhood demonstrations. They are very active in the Sinai against a growing rebellion, and the Islamist jihadist groups have said, led by Al-Qaeda, but there are 15 others, that this is the new front against America and the Zionists. Declared that this will be the battleground, and you know how long saying that the Sinai will become the new Sumatra, will be the new front line. Well, we're seeing it there. There's a big buildup of missiles. The Egyptian army has built up. They've taken action. They're coordinating again with Israel on it. But Iran is supplying weapons. They're getting weapons from Libya still. So the Sinai is a big front for the Egyptian government. And the Egyptian government has to deal with this huge, overwhelming economic crisis. And I don't believe anybody yet has any answers as to how to handle it. And the Saudis and UAE are providing them with the funding. The United States cut off some weapons. It's not true we cut off everything and cut off all aid. But we did cut back on some, which sent the wrong signal. Then you see the flirtations with Russia by Al-Sisi. I don't believe that they can switch today from an American-based military system to a Russian one, but you could have additional gestures. And Russia coming back, you saw that Forbes listed him as the most powerful man in the world ahead of Obama, which is a major shift, and I'm not sure it's one that people should applaud.
Who feels more abandoned by the United States, Syrian rebels or the Egyptian government? Malcolm Honlein says...
Look... You know, when they read the article in last Sunday's Times where they discussed, you know, the priorities in U.S. policy, Iran negotiations, Syrian negotiations, Israeli-Palestinian negotiations, nothing about Egypt, nothing about the Gulf, nothing about Hezbollah Hamas, nothing about these other things. I'm not saying that they will ignore them. But the message repeatedly given is the wrong one to our allies and to other countries in the region. And the failure to act on Syria is something that the Turks and others hold against and many of the Gulf as well hold against us. The appearance of looking for a grand deal, which will not happen, and I think U.S. knows that there's not going to be a grand deal with them. The U.S. is getting out of Afghanistan. We see the situation in Iraq, the divisions. The Maliki was here this week, the Prime Minister, and I know members of Congress.
Yeah, what was the message to him from Washington? What was the... He comes
overflights by Iran to Syria, take greater control. You know, in the country, the crisis there in terms of the killings, which is all time high, thousands of people being killed in sectarian violence
in Iraq,
inside Iraq. In addition to the fact that Iraq has become a feeding channel to the war in Syria of terrorists and others who come from all over and go in, and the transfer of material. And they said that they would inspect every plane flying over, and we know they're not. We know that they're nighttime flights from Iran to Syria, bringing in all sorts of equipment.
Wow. You forget, well, not you, but some of us forget that there's still a player in this whole thing.
They are a very big player in all of this. And Iraq today is divided, east-west, Sunni, Shiite. The violence today, more people are being killed than during the war. I mean, the number of attacks, we see them in piecemeal, but 50 people, 80 people, 100 people can be killed in a single attack, and it goes on all the time.
Wow. All right, a couple more things since we're already at our deadline. Israel agreed this week to Israel agreed this week to a United Nations human rights review?
They agreed to cooperate, which I haven't done for years, but
yeah.
They got some new assurances to this review where they come and they look at what Israel's doing. I don't think Israel has anything to hide. They broke it because this one-sided, predetermined condemnations that, you know, are done annually by the Human Rights Council, by the other entities of the United Nations.
I just think it's dangerous for Israel. Even if they have nothing to hide, I think it's dangerous for Israel to agree to a sort of inspection like that.
Well, this way, at least they have some say in it. They participate, and the condemnation will come anyway. So you might as well.
That's true. That's true. They're going to be condemned anyway. That's true. There was optimism I read this week from Iran and the IAEA regarding a nuclear capability and the way Iran is going. Is there any reason to believe any of that?
There's reason to believe that they are speeding up the process. We saw estimates now, even coming from official sources and the Institute of National Strategic Studies, which said, I think, a month to a month and a half. Now, we have to understand that each of the people who's speaking, and Amos Yadlin said a month, other people said several months, they're all talking about different phases of the same process. It's a question of when do they have enough enriched uranium. They all agree that they have at least 7 tons of enriched at 3.5%. They have also enriched to 20%. It's a much shorter period than, you know, to get it to 90%. They have to get to 90% enrichment. Then you have to fit it to a weapon. Then you have to put it on a missile launcher. So that whole process could be a year off. And it would take probably 3 months till they got the stuff into a weapon. But what they're saying is that they could break out within a month. And when the debate now focuses on eliminating the 20%, it's no longer relevant because the new centrifuges they put in can go skip this stage and go right in a process from 5%, let's say, to the 90%, when before they would stop. And as it is, they've tried to keep the amount below the red line set by Netanyahu, which would have triggered an Israeli response. But they're moving ahead, constantly putting in new centrifuges, constantly expanding their capacity, and we see that the level of activity in this regard, while they are engaging in the negotiation process, they are moving ahead. There's even talk of the Iran-Pakistan gas line will be extended to China, which will give $7 billion a year to Iran.
Oh.
They are hurting. The new bill in Congress would cut the exports from 1 million barrels a day to 500,000 barrels. But they will take advantage, and they're going to continue to lie and obfuscate. And again, as I said, look at who's in the government. Look at what the track record of Rouhani is, that he admits he lies, he distorts. And their continued support for terrorism, execution. They gave lashings to Christians because they participated in a communion. They drank wine, a minimal amount. And the real key here is that we need to see a process. And if negotiations has to be sped up, you know, they hardly talk about the plutonium facility in Iraq, this heavy water reactor. Once that goes online, you can't bomb it because the radiation and the contamination that would follow would be very severe.
Finally, did inspectors get to all of Syria's declared chemical sites?
All the declared chemical sites. And as I said, we don't know what's not declared. We don't know what, as in the case of Iran, we don't know what facilities,
right, what they're hiding.
They have, but just remember, look at how of the nature of the involvement. There is a video that shows, that was captured, of Iranian involvement in Syria. You get to see the extent, who gives the orders, how far they've come, and all of these governments, Syria, Iran, they lie. It is a tradition. It is how they conduct business. They think it's in fact mandated. So the fact that they say they destroyed it, they didn't say that they destroyed all their stockpiles. We don't know what it may be hidden in different places.
Right. Malcolm, the next time we speak, there'll be a new mayor elect in New York City.
Very likely, and I hope everybody will have voted for one candidate or another and have been part of the process and let the world know that we care and that we're involved and we're making our voices heard.
Thank you so much. Malcolm Hoenlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations.